This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Last Monday, Labor Day, marked the unofficial end of the summer season and a final chance to partake in its pleasures. But as reports of stagnant wages, underemployment, and rollbacks on workplace discrimination protections persist, reminders of Labor Day's original purpose have begun resurfacing. Chris Thomas has this. Brother Cruz gave a
report, old business none. This is what organized labor sounds like in eastern North Carolina. It's a lodge meeting for the AFL-CIO's District 110, headquartered in Havelock. It's a rarely heard sound throughout the state. North Carolina is the second least unionized state in the country, with only 4.1% of all workers affiliated with unions of some kind. The national average is 11.1.
You don't see it taught in the schools, the labor, the history of labor, and how people fought for the 40-hour work week.
That's Tony Cruz, Central Labor Council President for the Eastern North Carolina branch of the state's AFL-CIO. He's also a member of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, also known as IAM.
How people fought for workplace safety protections, child labor, overtime after 40 hours, time and a half. A lot of the things, holidays, medical coverage for employees as a benefit, retirements and pensions, all of these things that labor unions fought for and in many cases died for, bled for, it's not really taught.
It was something relatively foreign to Ruth Ann Bonebrake, also of Havelock, before she joined the IAMs. She's currently the district lodge's secretary and worked as an office secretary before that.
And I saw from the management viewpoint how they treated the employees. And when I had the opportunity to actually become a member of the union, get out of the secretarial trade, I realized after looking at the negotiated agreement that things just weren't right.
These days, the jobs in eastern North Carolina are where unions usually aren't. The U.S. Labor Department reported occupations with among the highest rates of employment in North Carolina, including sales and food preparation and service, are also among the least unionized nationwide and have the lowest wages on average. Agriculture, fishing, and forestry, ingrained in the eastern North Carolina culture and economy, is the least unionized category in the country. Only 25 individuals, nationwide, in those occupations are represented by a union in the U.S. Stats show a strong correlation between higher wages and union membership, which means reports of job growth across the state aren't necessarily reports of job quality growth, especially in more rural areas like eastern North Carolina. Economist for the NC Justice Center, Patrick McHugh.
A lot of that economic activity is increasingly clustered in a few urban areas across the state. And so even while statewide the unemployment rate has come down, employment is up, there's still lots and lots of communities that are worse off than before the recession, and some communities that have even lost ground over the last year.
The unemployment rate has dropped throughout much of the state, but eastern North Carolina still has some of the highest rates. Late last month, the North Carolina Department of Commerce reported the Rocky Mount, Fayetteville, Greenville, Goldsboro, and Jacksonville metropolitan statistical areas had the highest rates of unemployment in the state.
The simple fact of the matter is there are more folks looking for work today than there were before the recession started. And you wouldn't expect that to be the case after one of the longest periods of uninterrupted growth nationally. That shouldn't be the case, that we're still seeing a huge chunk of folks, nearly a quarter million North Carolinians looking for a job today. So that's not the sign of a healthy labor market.
But that doesn't stop some from organizing. UE150 founder and retired drug abuse center worker Don Cavallini is one of those people. He believes low union membership in North Carolina can be attributed to something more insidious.
The conditions that employers have workers under is deliberate ignorance of their benefits, so that even when there's a federal law that covers everybody, like the National Labor Relations Act in the private sector and Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA, many workers, well-educated, at least formal educated employee, like a nurse, does not know that they can avail themselves of unpaid family leave.
UE150 membership is mostly made up of factory workers and state employees, especially from the Department of Health and Human Services. They've recently organized rallies and campaigns for better pay in Rocky Mount and Kinston. State workers are barred from collectively bargaining with their employer in North Carolina. Mr. Cavallini said that forced UE50 to get creative.
There are various ways to pressure employers, especially if it's the government, because ultimately we vote for our bosses.
North Carolina is what's known as a right-to-work state. a loosely defined term incorporating 25 additional states that have strong checks on union power. People like Mr. Cruz and Mr. Cavallini are staunch opponents. But George Leaf of the right-leaning Pope Institute believes it's misunderstood. He's an expert on the subject and wrote Free Choice for Workers, A History of Right to Work, and said those laws were passed to protect workers that are unwillingly part of unions.
Workers who had been voted into a union by majority vote, but who didn't want that to pay for the dues, at least, could keep their jobs and not be fired.
Large unions, or big labor, as Dr. Leaf calls them, have a long history of strong-armed intimidation tactics to keep rank-and-file members in line and non-members off the shop floor altogether. The right-to-work movement, Dr. Leaf says, started in the South in the 1930s and 1940s as the labor movement approached its zenith north of the Mason-Dixon line. North Carolina was among the first states to adopt right-to-work laws, and the movement has grown to include states where labor once loomed large.
I think what it reflects is a growing discontent with big labor, its agenda, and more workers are feeling, you know, we want to exercise our rights, and they're getting in touch with their elected representatives and state capitals and saying we like the freedom to make up our own mind whether unionism is something we want to pay for or not.
Like Mr. Cruz and Mr. Cavallini, Dr. Leaf emphasizes the fact that unionizing is not illegal in right-to-work states and gives some credit to unions for better working conditions in America. Just not all.
Safety improved long before, was improving and can continue to improve with or without unions across the whole of America. Working conditions have improved because it's in the interest of employers to make sure their workers are content whether they have unions or not.
Historian and factory worker Jim Wren of Rocky Mount, however, says unions have been one of the few sources of recourse for workers in North Carolina, especially black workers.
I say the union has overcome a lot of racial divisions, and why it's always trying to fight for unity of workers in spite of those forces out there that would instigate racial division.
Eastern North Carolina is home to several historic markers paying tribute to organized labor, one in Tarboro for the Knights of Labor of the late 19th century, and another to Operation Dixie in Rocky Mountain in 1946, the year before North Carolina passed its initial right-to-work legislation. Both predated major milestones in the civil rights movement and were led primarily by black workers for justice, on and off the clock.
One of the big issues going on then was the sexual harassment of these white foremen in these tobacco plants, harassment of the black female workers. And this union movement gave workers the opportunity to stand up to the harassment of the white foremen.
Wren said race and labor are intertwined and have overcome severe pushback in eastern North Carolina, and will continue to do so.
We see a new labor movement on the rise. $15 hour minimum wage was seen as maybe impossible a couple of years ago, but now we're seeing victories in this movement.
Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Justice Center believes these are exciting times. His employer writes a yearly State of the Worker report.
We are at a point where workers are increasingly recognizing that they need better bargaining position, stronger bargaining position, in order to keep their job, protect their job, earn better wages, get the benefits that are increasingly vanishing.
Organized labor and right-to-work factions will most likely continue clashing in the region for years to come, even as they claim the same goal: better working conditions for workers and a better life for their posterity. I'm Chris Thomas.
Today on the Down East Journal, we explore how prepared local healthcare providers are when it comes to the uncertainty surrounding Zika infection and microcephaly in infants. According to the North Carolina Division of Public Health, southeastern North Carolina has the highest birth rate in the state. This fact may play in favor of early detection and early intervention should Zika become a real threat here in eastern North Carolina. Zika is still a mystery to health experts like Dr. Keith Ramsey, a retired epidemiologist and medical director of infectious control at Vidant Medical Center in Greenville.
It's very frightening. You know, we all get older and want to start families. Everybody wants perfect babies, or certainly close to perfect babies.
According to a study by the Wall Street Journal, it takes a little under $250,000 to raise the average child in the U.S. to adulthood. with the health and wellness complications that come with microcephaly.
They've estimated maybe $5 million lifetime cost for those babies who would require special care. So that's the long-term concern about it.
Thankfully, Zika doesn't seem likely in eastern North Carolina since the Aedes aegypti, the mosquito breed with the highest rate of Zika transmission, isn't generally found in our region. Dr. Stephanie Richards, an entomologist and professor at East Carolina University, said even if it was, the coming winter would severely dampen its threat.
Aedes aegypti is a subtropical tropical mosquito, so it really thrives in Florida, and that, a little bit more south.
Another Zika carrier, the Asian tiger mosquito, is the most common in the region, but has a low transmission rate for now. In North Carolina, additional safeguards have been put into place to keep Zika in check, namely the North Carolina Public Health Preparedness and Response, which monitors residents returning from endemic nations like Brazil. They work with the Zika Task Force, led in part by ECU.
There have been some instances where we have gone out to collect mosquitoes at these people's residences, and they've been sent to ECU for Zika testing.
But September is prime time for tropical storms, as evidenced last week with Tropical Storm Hermine. With an especially active season in the forecast, Dr. Richards urges residents to keep applying the mosquito repellent and practice safe sex with partners who may have visited Zika-prone areas.
We're always watching the weather, so it's not over yet. We still have another good month or two of, mosquito activity, so we're not out of the woods yet. So we still need to remain cautious and vigilant.
For now, that watchful state begins with screening pregnant women for the virus if they show symptoms or have traveled to Zika-prone areas such as Central and South America. And state health officials will continue to collect mosquito samples in Onslow County, the Albemarle Health District, Camp Lejeune, New Hanover County, Brunswick County, and Pitt County to make sure that the Zika-carrying Aedes aegypti mosquito doesn't show up here. Dr. Fernando Moya is a neonatal specialist and medical director of the New Hanover Regional Medical Center's Children's Hospital and leads a private neonatal practice with satellite offices at four other hospitals, two of which are in Onslow County.
Once the baby is born with microcephaly, there's really not a lot you can do. So the emphasis needs to be placed in healthy habits.
Moya stresses the importance of prenatal care, especially now in the wake of U.S.-acquired Zika cases reported in Florida. Zika has been linked to microcephaly, a devastating condition in which a person's head is abnormally small. Diagnosing microcephaly can be done using ultrasound late in the second trimester or early in the third trimester.
It can either be isolated, that is, a baby is born, has a normally sized body and weight, and the head is proportionally much smaller, or it can be the baby just entirely small, including a smaller head.
Other physical and psychological disorders are linked to microcephaly, including impaired vision, seizures, and developmental delays.
If you have microcephaly, the odds of being normal are low.
Moya says microcephaly is rare at his practice. Generally, they encounter only one case out of 1,000 babies born. Zika isn't the only cause either. Other factors, including rubella and exposure to alcohol and certain narcotics, can lead to this life-changing condition.
There's some genetic causes. There's some syndromes. There's some genetic problems that feature microcephaly as part of usually a constellation of findings. It's usually not just isolated microcephaly. And those infants notoriously do very poorly.
However, if there is a widespread outbreak of microcephaly due to Zika in our area, Moya says there will likely be an increased emphasis on preventive measures and says treatment for babies born with microcephaly will ramp up.
The medical schools around us, ECU to the north, Duke Chapel Hill have. We have our own pediatric neurology program here in Wilmington. So we have the availability of the specialists to help treat the manifestations or consequences of microcephaly.
Moya believes, at the moment, our medical professionals are prepared.
I would be really hard-pressed to believe that we could face really an epidemic of microcephaly, because just about the only thing that could be construed as a cause of that would be a massive spread of Zika virus.
For now, healthcare professionals in our area seem confident of their ability to stay on top of expected cases of microcephaly that develop in our general population. But with the uncertainty of how far Zika may spread in the coming months or years, it is becoming more important than ever to practice personal responsibility in protecting yourself and others. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The sea turtle nesting season along our coast is winding down, and the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission is reporting a record year. So far, there have been 1,636 nests counted along 330 miles of ocean-facing sandy beaches in our state. That number is up from last year's count of 1,300 nests, and it's a significant jump from 2014, where 565 nests were reported. This week, Mac McKee speaks with sea turtle biologist with the North Carolina Sea Turtle Project, Matthew Godfrey, about how they collect their information and why there's been an increase in sea turtle nesting sites.
Matthew, do you have a system for averaging the number of nests that you see along the Crystal Coast in a given season?
We're very lucky that a lot of people are interested in sea turtles, and so we have an entire network of volunteers and collaborators statewide from the South Carolina border to the Virginia border that go out every day during the nesting season. So that's from basically May 1st through 31st of August. We'll go out every morning and look for tracks of nesting females, and they're pretty obvious on the sand. They're easy to find, and we get daily counts for 95% of our coastline on the ocean side, and that's where turtles lay their eggs.
Why is this a record year for sea turtles along the North Carolina coast?
We say it's a record year because we have the greatest number of nests that have been laid per year on record in North Carolina. Now, why that is, we're not entirely sure. We hope it means that there are more females in the population, and as a result, they're laying. The nests that are being laid is a reflection of that, but it could also be that the females are just able to lay more nests on average. A single female will lay 3 to 4 to 5 nests per season, and so you can imagine that in a particular year, if they lay, say, 6 on average instead of 4, you would see an uptick in numbers of nests laid.
On average, from, say, the nesting places along the Crystal Coast, from, say, Cape Lookout all the way to Emerald Isle, is there a certain place that usually has more nests than others?
Actually, the place with the highest density of nests in our area is actually Bear Island and Hammocks Beach State Park, which is just beyond Emerald Isle. They have the highest density of nests, but it's a relatively small island, so if you're just talking about islands themselves, in fact, Cape Lookout, South Corbanks, and North Corbanks have the greatest number of nests, but they're also some of the longest islands. And so the density might be low, but the overall number is quite high on Cape Lookout.
Well, what is overall the importance of the sea turtle to North Carolina's coastal environment?
Sea turtles play various roles in the ecosystem, and one of their roles actually is to provide prey to other animals. So sea turtles lay a lot of eggs and produce a lot of hatchlings, and of course, a lot of them don't actually make it to adulthood. Many of them are eaten by other animals, and so those hatchlings or young animals form an important source of prey for fish and other marine life. They also transfer nutrients from the ocean to the beach, which normally doesn't get very many nutrients, but by the fact that they lay their eggs there. And when the hatchlings leave, they leave behind eggshells and other things, and all that goes towards the beach dune system and helps the plants and other invertebrates that live in the dune system. And so it's an important source of energy, in the summer at least, for the dune ecosystem.
What is the North Carolina Sea Turtle Project, and what kind of positive research has it given you in determining the success of the sea turtle nesting habits?
The North Carolina Sea Turtle Project is essentially two separate projects. One is the Nest Monitoring and Protection Program, which we're talking about now, and the other one is the Stranding Response Network. There's a large overlap in the types of people and volunteers that work on both projects, but both projects aim to collect important information by which we can evaluate status and trends in the populations. And both types of data are shared with the federal government and are used for assessing recovery criteria for these species, which are listed on the Endangered Species Act.
I'm sure you're always looking for volunteers. What kind of special training do you prefer to give them?
We have many different volunteer groups working in the state, and each one is headed by volunteer coordinators who are responsible for training people. And if people are interested in volunteering with sea turtles, I suggest they contact the local sea turtle coordinators in their area.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. As I was working in the garden this week, I was pulling up tomato plants. And while most of the plants looked great, one or two were not as vigorous as the others. And when I pulled them up, the roots were short and knotted with small white swellings on them. Unfortunately, I now know that I have root knot nematodes in my vegetable garden. Nematodes are microscopic worms that live in sandy soils on the coastal plain. There are many species of nematodes, and many of them are beneficial, preying on pests, microorganisms, and even other nematodes. But some species feed on plant roots, stunting their growth. Several species of nematode are found in coastal North Carolina, but the most common and easiest to recognize is the root knot nematode. From above, the affected plants appear stunted and pale, even when you've applied adequate water and fertilizer. Usually, the first sign for me is that I think a plant needs a little bit of fertilizer, but it doesn't respond when I add it. Nematode-affected plants will also drop flowers and fruits and may wilt and decline altogether. The culprit is most obvious when the plants are pulled out of the ground at the end of the season. Root knot nematode-infected plants will have bumpy, knot-like galls on the roots where the nematodes have been feeding. Nematodes are a frequent problem on figs, resulting in fruit drop, yellowed or dropped leaves, and increased winter kill. They can also affect landscape plants and turf. I have seen nematode damage cause established evergreen hedges to slowly die back over time. Plants affected by nematodes usually decline slowly over a period of several years. Since other problems like root rot or too much fertilizer can cause symptoms similar to those produced by nematodes, it's a good idea to conduct a soil sample to look for nematodes. Unfortunately, there are no chemicals available that will kill nematodes in a home garden or landscape, but there are several steps that can be taken to manage them. In the vegetable garden, one of the easiest options is to grow vegetables that are not susceptible to attack, like sweet corn, asparagus, broccoli, cabbage, kale, collards, and mustards are naturally nematode-resistant. Among other crops, choose nematode-resistant varieties if they're available. For instance, Amelia and Celebrity varieties of tomatoes are both resistant to nematodes. There are other steps you can take to reduce nematodes in the garden as well. Certain cover crops can suppress nematode populations. Adding compost to the soil and solarization, a process where the soil is covered with clear plastic and allowed to heat, can help reduce nematode populations. Nematodes are unfortunately much harder to control in the landscape. Often the best option is to remove infected plants and replace them with resistant varieties. For lawns, providing optimum fertility and irrigation to prevent additional stress to the turf is your best option. If necessary, you may need to consider replacing the turf with a more vigorous selection or a different ground cover. If you suspect that nematodes are an issue in your lawn or garden, now is a good time of year to sample, as nematode populations should be at their highest. Contact your county cooperative extension office for sample boxes and detailed directions.
Next weekend, the annual North Carolina Shell Show again returns to the Cape Fear Museum of History and Science. Browse the scientific and arts and crafts exhibits in more than 20 categories, ranging from North Carolina collections and single shells to Moleskine natural history and shell photography.
My name is John Timmerman. I'm exhibits designer here at Cape Fear Museum. I'm also the chair of the North Carolina Shell Show. It's a gathering mostly of amateur collectors that come from all over the East Coast of the United States and bring their shell collections. We've got a man coming from Kentucky, a lady from Kansas, half dozen people coming up from Florida. They've developed professional quality exhibits based on themes from shells of Australia to shells found right here in North Carolina along the coast. It'll be a very unique opportunity for people to come in and to see such unusual shells. And they're not tiny. They're 2-3 inches in size. There are just literally tens of thousands of shells here. We do have a really special collection being shared with us this year. A lady from Virginia is bringing down a collection she borrowed from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. These are shells that were collected from deep sea thermal vents. We also have vendors here that have shells from around the world. They're cleaned up to perfection. A lot of the people that come to our show come specifically with them and do a little bit of shopping in mind. It's going to be held Saturday and Sunday, September 17th and 18th, and it's going to be at Cape Fear Museum here in Wilmington, North Carolina. The Saturday hours are 9 to 5, and the Sunday hours are 1 to 5. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org's events calendar.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.